Welcome to Hollywood Unguided, the WeMax, a political podcast. Well, season 3, episode 12, season finale, which means it's exactly the same as the other 11 episodes of the season, but, you know, I'll try and make it seem more interesting. Joining me today, well, I'll introduce myself. I'm a bit big-headed and just assume everybody knows who I am, but I'm sure this is somebody's first podcast. So I'm your host, David McClement, and I'm recording from the Blantyre Free State. And joining me is my eternal comrade. She's here every week, and she'll always be here, whether she wants to or not. It's the digital Michelangelo my guy, Deborah Torren.
Hi.
Also joining us, I was going to say, technically he's not standing in for Brian, since Brian's now officially left, the bastard. So I suppose our first guest contributor, permanent guest contributor, I don't know, is our man in Dundee. He's the only monolingual member of the Beaton clan, Mr. Conor Beaton.
Thanks very much. I like to think of myself as the anti-Brian now, so happy to be here.
How's things, everybody?
All right.
I've been very much enjoying House of the Dragon.
Is that the Game of Thrones spin-off?
It is the Game of Thrones spin-off. I love Game of Thrones. I still defend season 7 and 8 to people.
So now I know I can just write out your opinion of House of the Dragon then.
House of Dragon's amazing. Love the first episode. I've officially not seen the second episode because I'm watching it tonight with my wife. But I did watch the first. I did watch it today. But
I'm telling Caroline.
You'll tell Nate.
I'm going to text him.
See, my partner's refusing to watch it because she's such a big Lord of the Rings fan. In fact, I think I mentioned last time I was on here that she has a Lord of the Rings podcast. And she's waiting anxiously for Rings of Power, which is also starting this week.
Yep.
And she can't watch House of the Dragon because she doesn't want to be like comparing them in her head.
Yeah, I can see how that might happen. I don't know. I'll be watching both of them. I don't think I could not watch House of the Dragon, even if I wanted to. I was the same with Game of Thrones. It's the only thing that's ever made me look forward to a Monday. A very weird experience. I watch Lord of the Rings as well when it comes, and we'll see how it is. I'm a wee bit more skeptical about that than House of the Dragon.
My girlfriend's never seen any episodes of Game of Thrones.
See, when somebody says that, I feel jealous of them. They just think they've got this great wonder in their future if only they go and seek it out.
I know, I told her.
So it's sitting in a winning lottery ticket, no cashing it in.
Do you like Game of Thrones, Deborah?
Yeah, I like them very much. I didn't mind season 7 or 8 either. I thought it changed things
up. It wasn't perfect, it had issues.
Exactly, lots of issues.
But I can't be bothered with this kind of extreme hatred that people have got and refusal to see any benefits. You know,
I'm just joking, by the way. I don't actually have very strong feelings about Game of Thrones. I started reading the books just before the series premiered because when I found out it was happening, I thought I should probably read this. And I read all the way up until, I think, The Red Wedding, and then I kind of stopped reading them in half. And then I kind of picked up with the show. So I never really had any strong investment, but I think just the ending just didn't really make any big impression on me. That was all.
Anyway, I think we should stop talking about this because otherwise it won't be an hour in and then suddenly I remember it's not a Game of Thrones podcast. So I say we should get on gag. And it was nice to hear you smile. Dream a dream cause you'll never die. Stars will never overtake the sky. Life has its turns and it takes a while. And it was nice, nice to hear you smile. Okay, first item on the agenda. UK households will pay almost triple the price to heat their homes this winter compared with a year ago. An increase for millions of people already struggling to afford everyday essentials. The industry regulator, Ofgem, raised its cap on domestic energy bills to a record £3,549 beginning in the 1st of October. That's expected to go even higher in January as companies compete with other nations, as the UK competes with other nations for limited gas supplies. The announcement led to protests outside Ofgem offices in London and Glasgow from groups such as Don't Pay UK and Power to the People. Deborah, it's not really a price cap if they just keep raising it every few months, is it?
No. It's no, it's ridiculous, unbelievable. Up to £700 a month folk could be paying for their bills. How is that even possible? And people on prepayment meters, they're going to be struggling even more. We had a few wee tips circulating on the Ungagged channels. Cancel your direct debit and just pay for what you use. They'll try and tell you, oh, you'll pay more because you're not getting the direct debit discount. But for me personally and we, Jeannie, we found that it's much easier to manage our bills that way. Also looking at some other tips, such as putting tinfoil or not actual tinfoil, like insulating reflective foam. Somebody said there's stuff from NASA you can buy on eBay. I don't know how accurate that is, but it's some sort of thermal insulation you put it behind your radiators, can help deflect the heat back in the room. Also looking at terracotta plant pots, where you stack them up with tea lights under them as wee room heaters. It's quite low cost efficient, but I don't know how safe they are.
In a house with a toddler, I would say not safe at all.
No, don't. I wouldn't let toddlers near them. And it's kind of making me worry about Jeannie because she might try and heat her hands up on it. It's unbelievable that this is 2022. We have all the technology we've got, all this potential renewable energy systems, and we're still relying on stupid gas. And do we still have coal-fired power stations in the UK? Are they all decommissioned?
I think we still have some. Well, they're talking about building a new coal mine in the borders, aren't they?
Really?
They are regressing. They're sending mines.
Well, with all that red tape we've saved with Brexit, we can probably send 8-year-olds and stuff in as well. They can get the wee bits of coal right at the back.
I mean, get the pensioners in there. They're not doing anything anyway. Keep them warm. It's a joke.
They keep voting Tory and getting us in this mess. They can go down the mine.
Every single person who voted Tory should get like a one-way ticket down the mine. They have to dig it up. We won't even burn the coal because it's bad for the environment, but I think they should be, you know, doing something to keep busy.
Or wait till they're all in. Seal it up.
I'm crying. The red tape argument, though. Did you see there's some right-winger on Twitter who is saying we need to cut the red tape that says you can't, like, burn books in your home that, you know, pensioners have a way of heating themselves this winter.
How many people have an open chimney these days?
Yeah.
Really?
Because when I was carbon monoxide.
I know, because when I was wee and we had one, it was a bit of an oddity having an open coal fire. I don't know many people. Have you got an open coal fire in your house, David?
Well, kinda. We thought we did. There was a guy that done whatever he did today in the chimney, and after he done it, we were like, we might get like a wood burner or something put in it later date. And he went, oh, you should have told me that before. I went, oh, but I did a whole different thing. Well, all right, I guess we're not getting one of them.
I remember when I was growing up, we lived in a cottage that the central heating system broke down, and the person that came out to repair it basically said that they weren't allowed to have this kind of central heating system. It was installed completely illegally, so it wasn't a straightforward repair. It was a rented place. So we decided to get a wood burning stove as an alternative way to heat the home. And we managed to find one secondhand, and we went out and picked it up and brought it home and put it in the living room, and then realized that we didn't have like a chimney and we didn't really have a way of putting one in. So it just kind of sat in the living room as like a reminder of a poorly thought through idea.
That's a good point you made there, Connor, just related to the energy prices. See, folk who are in rented accommodation, they don't have the luxury of being able to make their house more efficient, insulating it, changing the windies, putting in better heating systems, more efficient boilers. So you just touched on a wee point there. Yeah. Can you put in wood burning stoves?
I mean, I feel particularly stupid because I'm in a rented place. And when we rented this last year, you know, we spent a lot of time trying to look for a place that we'd like, specifically a place that would have a gas hob, because I'm sick of using these awful electric hobs you get in a lot of rented places. Well, gas central heating, because I hate a lot of these electric heaters you get that barely work. A few other things. But yeah, now we've got gas everything, just in time for the gas price to rocket up. And we're not even on a fixed tariff because we can't get off of that where we are. So a really, really own goal on that one.
Yeah, that one backfired. Yeah, I mean, I've not had any word about our bills going up again. I mean, they obviously went up sort of just before the summer. They almost doubled in price. And I've got a lot of kids, so it's quite a big house. So we probably use a lot of energy. Mom's disabled, so she's in the house through the day. So, you know, it's not like, you know, some households where they maybe no use any energy, like 9 to 5 or whatever. But I worry what ours might shoot up there because we must use a lot of energy.
Especially because the numbers that keep getting thrown around are for what an average 2-bed household. You know, you have to worry what that actually looks like for, you know, bigger families, disabled people, folk who don't have an average household. I don't even know what an average household looks like.
I was reading an interesting thing about the different types of households, and just broadly, most energy consumption is very similar, like unless you're in a big stately home or something like that. And it was because they were saying that the newer built houses that have got more bedrooms are a bit more efficient, basically. But you're right, it's an average, so there could be really terribly insulated two-bedroom homes whose their prices are going to be even more than that average estimate, which is just what is happening. And why is the UK so uniquely more expensive? Like, if you look at the average prices right across the rest of Europe, this prices are going up, but not as drastically as here. What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, because gas price, the wholesale gas price is shooting up and other countries are competing for it. So, you know, a lot of people keep mentioning this is nonsense because we only get like 5% of gas by Russia, but other countries that get a lot of gas by Russia that maybe isn't getting it are now trying to buy from the supplies that the UK would have used. But it's not translating through to individual household bills in other countries, presumably because their governments are taking steps to stop that. Like France, they didn't raise the cap, unlike Ofgem, who took me to raise the cap but a moment's notice.
And was it 80% of increase that buy since?
The latest one's 80%, an 80% rise, you know, saying it will be more than January. So
yeah. I just don't understand how anyone's going to be able to, if people are going to actually afford to pay it. It's just, you can't imagine where the money's going to come from. And I think that's the point that, you know, there's the debate about non-payment and the groups like Don't Pay that have been calling for a mass non-payment. I think they've called it like an energy bill strike to try and force the government to do something. And the most persuasive argument that I've heard for that is actually the point that there's going to be probably millions of people in the UK who are going to cancel their direct debits and not pay. Not because they want to be part of some campaign or not to make a political stand, but because they literally cannot pay it. And so the least you can do is, if you're in a position to stand, take a stand in solidarity with them by doing the same and kind of clogging stuff up. So I don't know. I don't know what else we have because, you know, as you said, David, there have been big protests outside Ofgem HQ in Glasgow and London, and they've been really impressive. Like, I'm really impressed by the number of people they've got out, and clearly it's something that a lot of people are really worried about. And we actually had a demonstration just around the corner from my house on Friday down at Lockheed Community Larder. There was a little kind of impromptu protest in March down to Lockheed High Street. Yes. And, you know, folk were, it was great. We marched past, it was in the middle of Friday. I just finished work because I do a half day. And we went past a primary school and all the kids were waving at us. So it was quite, it was great, like, vibes. And people were obviously interested and coming along and, you know, chanting. But the problem is, I just don't know how much protesting is actually going to do, because if we've learned anything from the UK politics in the last few years, it's no matter how many people you have out protesting, it can just be so easily ignored because we are not in a particularly democratic state. You know, we've got a Tory government that's been trying to suppress any kind of form of democracy. You know, we've had, the one thing that's made a difference recently has been strikes, and they're talking about, well, we need to make strikes harder to do legally. We need to do away with you know, they've already changed the law to let agency workers in to scab on unionized workers who are on strike. Talking about banning strikes in certain industries. Liz Truss, certainly, if she gets in, I'm sure we'll talk about that. But the one thing that seems to be, you could actually force these energy companies into a climb then, would be not paying. What are they going to do if we don't pay?
It's just, it puts so many folk at risk. That's what I worry about. Like, there's so many vulnerable people that not having power or heating is just, it's not a choice. They've got, you know, a medical equipment they need to run, they've got to stay warm, they've got to refrigerate insulin. Like, there's such a broad range of reasons why folk wouldn't want to do that, because it would be so stressful for them, which would further implicate their health.
I worry as well about trying to organise a non-payment, and I might be totally wrong in this, but it's like, the energy companies will go after some people. They might not be able to go after everybody. And I certainly don't want it to be me. I don't want to advocate somebody else and convince them to do it. And then they're one of the ones that the energy company tries to make an example of. So I don't necessarily disagree with it, but it kind of scares me at the same time. But I don't have a better idea either.
I totally get that, because it scares me as well.
I have a better idea. Community-owned renewable energy systems everywhere. Just start digging holes, right down geothermal heat every community for free. By the government. That's it. That's my solution.
I'll get a spade.
honestly, like that, I honestly think that's something that could be really quickly implemented because it doesn't take, you know, huge big building infrastructures like geothermal heating for every old person's house.
I mean, the general public, you know, the vast majority of the public kind of doesn't really think about politics that much, but they don't really have a choice about this. This is something that's engaging everybody, and it's concerning everybody. You know, I was watching the Celtic Dundee United game yesterday, and there was anti-Tory chant here on the telly, which I don't think I ever heard at a match with like thousands of people before, as much as I don't think they would be fans of the Tories generally, but that's like a change to me. And the Tories are quite clever usually about picking off like individual groups and hammering them and, you know, winning the individual battles. But a bit like the poll tax with Thatcher, they get arrogant when they get too many victories. And to be honest, most of my life has been full of Tory victories, I'm sorry to say. And they get to a point where they think they can take on the entire working class. And I feel as if we might be reaching a point like that where they're trying to do it again. Mm-hmm. And they will lose. It's just it's going to be a battle, and it's going to be quite nasty, and a lot of people's lives will get crushed in the process. But in the end, the Tories will lose it. But, that was depressing.
Yeah, so much of everything is. I think this is a real test of people's ability to stay upbeat at the minute, as it has been for so long.
And I think it's okay to feel overwhelmed by the situation just now. I think everybody feels exactly the same. It's an overwhelming world we live in. I feel like we're at the end of humanity, or we're just at the precipice of a brand new enlightenment. I don't know. Could go either way.
Do you think we can get the rights for "It's the End of the World as You Know It"?
I'll just play it anyway. I don't care.
As long as you keep it less than 30 seconds, I think that's the rule. I mean, there's also the option that we just tax the oil companies until they squeal,
exactly,
and then use that to subsidise everybody's bill, which I presume is a variation in what most other countries are doing. God, it's going to affect so many people, including Tory voters. Most Tory voters probably aren't, you know, your Lord Snooty who doesn't need to worry about things like this. But
and the MPs themselves making these decisions, they're getting the energy paid on their expenses. Liz Truss claimed $5,000. That's some likey bill.
Do you remember a few years ago when the Queen apparently applied to some full poverty fund to keep Buckingham Palace?
We covered it in this very podcast.
you gotta worry, you know, like she's definitely gonna fall in hard times with that.
No, she's done her last 50 million or whatever. Probably more than that. I don't know. Once it gets more than 50 million, my brain doesn't really process how much that is.
She could burn some hats.
That's what we need to do. We need to abolish the red tape so that the Queen's allowed to heat her home with her hats.
Burn some corgis.
I did see Nadine Dorries, who was like, if you're cold this winter, you should get a pet because they warm you up.
It looked a bit insinuating something else, didn't it?
She's lying under a Doberman or something.
She's like, my furs are so warm.
Cruella de Vil, make a coat out of Dalmatians.
Cruella de Vil was smart over them. Okay, now that we're depressed ourselves, let's move on to something even more depressing. The latest in the Tory leadership race. We're now in the final week of this marathon Tory leadership contest, with the results due to be announced on Monday the 5th of September, with all the polls indicating that it will be Prime Minister Liz Truss. The latest for the Sunak campaign is he says that government gave too much power to scientists during COVID lockdowns, and it was wrong to scare people with posters showing COVID patients and ventilators. And the latest on the Truss side, she's insulted the President of France by saying the jury was out and whether he was a friend or foe of Britain. It's been a long road. Connor, what's your thoughts on this?
I'll be first. Oh, boy. I mean, I kind of got sideswept by the Tory leadership contest because I was really sure it was going to be Rishi Sunak, like, from the start. I don't know why. I didn't want it, but I just thought that was the most, you know, realistic candidate. And of course, this whole race has actually been about who can sell, you know, the worst possible policies to the worst possible constituency of people in the country, which is Tory party members. There's not a great deal of them either. I can't believe that it's going to be Liz Truss. I feel like personally embarrassed to the point of humiliation when she does her like Thatcher cosplay thing. She dresses up like her, she tries to, like, it's so hard for me to watch. I could never watch the the British office because that kind of like cringe humor, I can't stand it. I just physically can't stand it. And that's how I feel when I watch Liz Truss speak at all.
My girlfriend's got that same thing. She can't watch anything that's too cringe. Like you will literally be watching a film, sitting eating popcorn, and she'll just switch the channel. She says it's too cringe.
Yeah, like hands over my ears. I think she's, like, obviously I think she's incompetent. I think she's incredibly right-wing, but she also just seems so unprepared to be leading a country that it's almost worse imagining that than this kind of thing we're in now, where Boris Johnson has already said he's resigning and he's just like partying out the last few weeks. You know, it's just, I can't imagine how she's going to, is it this week? Is it the end of this week he'll find out that she'll take the reins?
A week today.
Okay.
As we're recording.
And not a single, I don't have a single expectation that she's going to announce something that'll make life easier for the millions of people who are panicking this winter. You know, the policies she's talked about, like, we're going to get the national insurance increase reversed. We're going to take the green levy off energy bills. Like, it's literal pennies that we're talking about here.
I think I heard that costed that for the very richest, that would take off about £1,000 off their bill. But for the very poorest, it would be like £90 a year.
Yeah.
And that's just perfect Tory policy, isn't it?
Yeah, typical.
I went to the protest in Perth outside the Tory party hustings, which I didn't unfortunately get to catch sight of either of our candidates, although a friend of mine did say that he saw Rishi Sunak leaving in his car and got a real shouting from police to stay away from it.
Were you at any time involved in the egging?
I did not egg anyone. Well, this is the thing. So there's a definitely like a narrative that there was like a horrible, violent kind of thing towards Tory party members there. But somehow, despite the fact that the police had created this barrier route into the venue for the Tory party members to use, and then all these barriers a few meters away for all the protesters to stand behind, who were very obviously like a mass of protesters, you would not believe the number of like confused Tory party members who were just walking through the protest to get to the front and then being like, oh, sorry, I need to go through, I've got a ticket. And the police let them through the barrier. And like not a single one that I saw got jostled. In fact, they tended to, you know, we said like shame on you at some of them. And they just kind of laughed at us and kind of gave us the finger and were waving Vs and everything. And it's just kind of, I wish some of them did get egged.
That's what we were saying. Well, that's what I was saying in the podcast last week.
Yeah, we should have had you here last week. First eyewitness account.
It was quite good, actually. You know, it was one of the, you know, it was a great spirit to, that I've not seen at protest for a while.
Deborah, what's your thoughts on the latest in the Tory leadership shenanigans?
I just think the two of them have some cheek. They're standing up behind those podiums saying, oh, we've done this one. The government was wonderful right through the pandemic. And Rishi Sunak and his, how many millions was it for the eat out to help out? Why don't you all go in a room with others in the height of the pandemic?
I forgot that even happened.
Exactly. And he's claiming it as some big success. And then what was Liz?
Well,
Liz Truss couldn't turn up to the BBC, the next Prime Minister. She was too busy. I don't think either of them are serious candidates by any means, and I had a premonition, Connor, that Liz Truss was accepting her leadership a speech, but she was dressed as Margaret Thatcher. Oh. It was a kind of dream nightmare thing, but it was a definite premonition. I should have put money on it. I could have paid off some electricity bills. Honestly, I've said this time and time again. Even Kat on the a couple of podcasts ago was berating me. I think Liz Truss is playing a character. She's playing a female version of Boris Johnson, and she's trying to replicate his sort of buffoonery, laissez-faire sort of attitude. Like, and it's coming across as she's a complete fucking idiot.
I mean, the stuff she said about Nicola Sturgeon a couple of weeks ago, and then stuff she's saying about the President of France this week, it's like, actually reminds me more of Trump, like in terms of, it's like she just talks to the people that are in the room, as if she forgets that, oh no, I'm an important person that people will repeat my comments and publicise them. You know, it's like she'd rather get an applause of some Tory pensioners in Eastbourne or wherever she was, rather than like thinking for a minute and went, okay, they'll like this, but it's likely to cause a bit of a diplomatic incident and make more hassle for me than the line. But it's like she can't think beyond that or beyond the situation. Like, just total Trump-like behaviour.
The Macron thing fascinates me because I have no idea why the interviewer asked her Macron friend or foe. Like, I have no idea what the concept, what the context for that is. But I think it's brilliant because I think that sets the standard now for every other interviewer. You've got to think of what is the most bizarre thing Liz Truss could say to put her foot in it. Frame it like a question and just let her run with it.
Oh, they should ask something about Biden and Irish republicanism or something like that.
It's like, who was it that I was asking her about cities in Russia and should we recognise Russian sovereignty? And she was like, no. And then but these cities are in Russia. Just after Ukraine got invaded. Like, I think we've got to do lots more questions like that. Just start throwing them in there. Like, should Germany be a single country? Just see what she says. She's going to have a great take.
Should France and Spain join a union?
Oh, I'm going to be sticking with these questions now, like my bed tonight. It's like, what crazy thing you could do just to humiliate? See, that's the thing, though. An actual journalist would get punished for that later, you know, as we'll touch on that, I suppose. I better know. Start talking about that now. Yeah, and Rishi Sunak, like, I think it was really trying to rewrite history, this idea that it was the scientists that were responsible for the lockdown.
Yeah.
Who was responsible for the lockdown was them not listening to the scientists and prolonging things to the point the lockdowns were longer and more severe because they allowed it to get to crisis point. You know, as if the second most powerful guy in the government, as if he had no responsibility over this happening. Oh, it was the scientists. Absolute clown.
If you're wanting to give power to anybody, then it should probably be people who know about it, as in scientists. But this idea that, what was it he said? They empowered scientists too much. Was that
gave too much power to scientists? What power did the scientists have? The scientists were coming on TV at their wits' end because the government were not listening to what they were saying.
Well, that's the thing, David. They gave TV shows to scientists, which is power, and then they gave tens of billions of pounds to their pals, which is just, you know, government, just good government.
That test and trace.
Yeah,
38 billion unaccounted for.
More than the Scottish Bloc grant.
More than 50 million, and I can't imagine that. So 38 million just blows my mind.
We've came to a depressing cul-de-sac again.
That seems to be where we're heading in this episode. So quite glad it's the last one of the season.
I think we're just pausing to try and process 38 billion pounds as a figure.
Yeah.
Hopefully, this time season 4, the revolution will happen and it will all be positive stuff we're saying about the new revolutionary government.
Yes.
Did you see the it was brilliant. Oh, the Tory cabinet up against the wall.
David, I can't put that in the podcast. Fucking Tories. Egging's one thing. We can promote egging.
Deborah,
time honoured tradition. Can't be said. I'm not gone soft.
You're gone soft on Toryism here. Just kidding.
I'm not keeping that in the podcast. I mean, you can't be saying we're going to move fucking Tories, no matter how much we want to. We can't say it.
I'll be Hollywood gagged. We'll get censored.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our sponsor this week is Sense of Nature Pet Service, based in central Scotland. Sense of Nature gives you a hands-on, personalised experience with a variety of exciting creatures, from snakes and skunks to tarantulas and turtles. Sense of Nature has something for everyone. They offer sensory sessions, one-to-one and group sessions, educational encounters for children of all ages, and they are available for private events upon inquiry. Animal welfare is at the forefront of everything they do, and if appropriate, a risk assessment can be carried out at no additional cost prior to your booking. To get 5% off your next booking with Sense of Nature, quote Hollywood Ungagged 5 at time of booking. To contact Sense of Nature, you can do so by email on sense.of.natureinquiries@outlook.com. You can also find them on most social media platforms by searching for Sense of Nature.
Okay, our next item. A GB News pundit has said that she was bullied out of the Conservative Party in a video recorded through tears and posted online. Sophie Kirkcaldy, 20, who appears on the Jeremy Bynes show and in ITV's Good Morning Britain as a right-wing commentator, has accused party colleagues of bullying her for having worked in KFC and for where she is from. For months and months on end, young Conservative-affiliated groups have been bullying me relentlessly in official group chats. Some of those individuals have made it possible for me to go to Conservative Association in Durham because of their obsessive bullying. Deborah, thoughts?
Don't ever feel sorry for a Tory, because they don't give a fuck about you. I'm really sorry. What the fuck did she expect? She's a working class woman going into a Tory party. Was she going to change the antiquated views on stuff? Like, what? Honestly, what did she expect? I have no sympathy. I actually was going to go get my ukulele and play the song because I thought you were going to go to Connor first, so you cut me off. I was a bit off key.
I did pause because I was trying to remember who I went to the last time.
Enjoyed the song.
Thanks. I have zero sympathy. A working class Tory, that's an oxymoron anyway. Mm. Fuck you then.
No sympathy for a young woman in politics getting bullied?
No.
No.
Yeah. what is it? If you run with the hounds? What is it? Hi, if you run with the hounds, you get tore apart like the poor fucking fox. I don't like bullies. Right, but if you go and hang a bit with the bullies and bully everybody else, you yourself become a bully. So I'm not going to feel sorry for you. I told you that would be my whole contribution.
I mean, I'm going to be boring and just agree. I don't feel bad for her. I've actually tried to go out of my way to avoid learning as much about her as possible. There was a moment where, knowing that this was going to come up in the podcast, I thought, should I read more about this? And then I just couldn't bring myself to get over how much I deeply don't want to. The person I really feel really sorry for, though, is the other Sophie Kirkcaldy, who's the journalist in Yorkshire, who gets a lot of unfair abuse that's aimed at the other Sophie Kirkcaldy. So to her credit, when this all broke out, she tweeted a little thing of, you know, you want this other woman, also up the striking workers. So there's like a good Sophie Kirkcaldy and a bad Sophie Kirkcaldy.
Yeah, she's famous on Twitter now as being the good Sophie Kirkcaldy.
Yeah, defend her, absolutely. Don't bully her.
Yeah, I mean, what do you say? It's like somebody who's dedicated their lives, they're only 20, dedicated their career so far to creating like a hateful environment, and then they get upset that they have to live in a hateful environment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, reminded me a lot of some of the kind of extreme right in America. They went through a period where they kept finding like very attractive young blonde women to be their spokespeople, and they all started leaving because we're like, do you know the neo-Nazis are quite disrespectful towards women? Yeah, that's right, you know. But it's a bit of that right-wing thing as well, of just complete lack of empathy. Like, you know, when it's happening to them, it's the worst thing in the world, but they have zero concern for the horrible things that they put out into the world that is a negative effect on other people.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you see that with a lot of these kind of online edgelord right-winger types, like Milo, whatever his name was, that disappeared. And, you know, he used like the fact that he was gay, so like, he could be the spokesman to cover all these extreme homophobic stuff that came out for people who supported. And then a lot of them turned on him because of his gay. Like, what did you think was going to happen?
I mean, I don't know why Sophie Kirkcaldy has been given this. Well, I do know why. She's been given this platform because she's convenient to be used as a woman, a working class person, a young person. It doesn't fit the Tory mould for them to be able to say, look, here, we're actually incredibly diverse and widely supported, etc. But I wonder if that's going to continue now that she's, you know, spoken out saying that she's been bullied by elements of the Conservative Party, if she'll still get given this platform, or they'll just immediately assume, she's a bit of a troublemaker, actually. Let's take this away and let's move on to someone else who'll, of course, come to fill that role. You know, I saw that someone actually said that for all these TV appearances, she was actually not getting paid, which I actually find embarrassing, because if you're going to, you know, let yourself be used in this way, at least get paid for it. It's less, you know, why would you do that for free?
I mean, the only level of sympathy or sort of compassion I have for the lassie is exactly as you said, Connor. She's been used. She's been absolutely used by the Tory party as this working class version of them. But she obviously didn't fit the mould because she didn't do what she was told.
I do wonder if, though, this is maybe just a step and maybe some kind of her career because I think she was unsuccessful for standing for some kind of Tory offices and as Tory candidate somewhere. Probably if I was a good host, I would have researched that. But
was it not something with the young Tories?
I think there was. I think she was a candidate during the local elections as well. So I think it's possible that she's realised she doesn't really have a future within the Tory party, and maybe she's making that break and trying to create a big, attention over that and pivot either to be a kind of attacking the Tories from the right and being a, setting herself up even more extreme right, or if she's some kind of delusions that she can pivot towards the left and she might find a home. In fact, maybe not that thing, mate. She might find a home with a Starmer Labour Party, who knows? Borders that they're happy to champion these days.
No coalitions with the SNP, but yes to Sophie Corcoran joining the NEC or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have trouble finding young people that support them because the young people overwhelmingly favour Corbyn over Starmer, so...
Sir Keir Starmer, give him his full title.
Yeah, you got to give him his full title.
I don't have to, but they've got to throw me in jail. This country, you can't even know say sir without getting thrown in jail. Our final topic of this evening. Former BBC journalist Emily Maitlis has said a BBC board member is an active agent of the Conservative Party who's shaping the broadcaster's news output by acting as the arbiter of BBC impartiality. The former Newsnight presenter highlighted the role of Robbie Gibb, who previously worked as Theresa May's Director of Communication and helped to found the right-wing GB news channel. Maitlis also raised concerns about the BBC's relationship with Conservative government, saying the broadcaster went out of its way to pacify Downing Street after she criticised Dominic Cummings for his breach of lockdown rule. Connor, BBC bias, it's not that surprising, is it?
No, it isn't. It's par for the course. I mean, credit to Emily Maitlis for pointing out what was increasingly obvious. But also, are we meant to genuinely believe there's only one Tory on the BBC board that she's singled out and it's not, you know, the rock goes deep throughout the whole organisation? And I probably include a lot of the journalists there as well. I mean, yeah, good on her for saying it, but it's not exactly news.
And she's not, it's not like she's became a whistleblower or uncovered.
No,
presented in. It's really just she's decided to express her opinion.
Yeah, she said something which was in the public domain already, but she's kind of shining a light. And it's such an interesting thing that it's because of something that she reported on where she wasn't happy with interference, because I'm sure there was many things that some of her colleagues would have been reporting on, especially more junior colleagues, where they were overruled. And I'm sure she probably knows a lot of examples of that. But she's not shared those with us at the moment. But certainly, I think, you know, I always get caught with the BBC because I know people who love the BBC, have always loved the BBC, who hate to see the direction it's going in. And you get people who will make the point, you know, defend the BBC from the Tory party because they want to defund it. They want to sell it off. You know, they hate the concept of public service broadcasting. They hate the idea of the government having a role. And what is likely going to happen is that space would be filled by even more right-wing broadcasters, privately owned. I have to say, my patience has run out. I'm sorry, I can't bring myself to care about defending the BBC on that basis anymore, because I think it is already there. There's the people who are put in by the Tory party to be, as Emily Maitlis said, agents of the Conservative Party. There's also all the other ones who are willing to self-censor and willing to adopt a certain style of journalism in order to placate those people, and they're just as bad as each other. Like, I don't really care if you're, you know, doing it out of political loyalty or if you're doing it because you're worried about your job or you're worried about, you know, if the BBC editorial direction goes too much this way, then it might impact decisions around the licence fee and stuff like that. You've just got a situation now where the BBC is enthralled to the Conservative Party, and I won't be sad to see it go.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many layers to the BBC by, you know, there's what Emily Maitlis is talking about, that sort of people who are clearly in there, you know, with the expressed aim of undermining it and not for political reasons. You know, there's overall culture in place. And then you get it right down to the basics of, you know, how many of their journalists are all, you know, Oxbridge, Etonians, or at very least public schools, you know, and you've got this revolving door between the BBC and the Tory party that's been going on for years. That slowly just creates a, I don't even know what word I was going to use there. But it creates a rot, you're right, that was what you used. It creates a rot that I don't know if you could get out of the BBC now. You know, I think we need a public service broadcaster. But how can you seriously try to make that argument in favour of the BBC? You know, certainly after, you know, its Scottish independence supporters, after the Indy ref and the way they reported in that and the way they favoured the unionist side. Mm-hmm. But I would like to think, in an independent Scotland, we would have a Scottish public service broadcaster. Isn't it called the SBC or anything like that? But, you know, what's the alternative, you know?
I mean, I actually think, to give us some credit, I think STV News is surprisingly good. And I've only really noticed recently how willing, and this is certainly in Dundee, I don't know if it's different, how willing STV crews are to come and cover things that are going on in the community. I've been at community events, like the opening of a new building for the community larder that's around the door for me, Robert Burns commemoration, the protest in Reveal Poverty that was this week, where there's an STV news crew that's come down and filmed it. And I've never seen a BBC news crew come to anything like that to cover it. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because they're trying to be apolitical. I don't know if it's trying to be, you know, they consider that below themselves, things that are happening in the community. But it's because, like, for me, I'm speaking also from a perspective of someone who works in the media. I do work as a journalist. I think journalism is really, really important. Like, I really strongly think that. And I think the decline in the media, I know people who, when there's job cuts at the Herald and the Scotsman, are like, way. Because they see the unionist bias there and they think, you know, we're better off without you. I don't think we're better off without newspapers and without BBC and without all these things, because I think there's a really important role that even bad journalism somehow fills to an extent, which is that we need information gathering as a social purpose. That's really important. But I think those things are totally incapable of doing it. And we need something to take the place. I think citizen journalism is really good, but there's also, we need to have professional journalists in communities reporting on the things that matter. And just, we're not getting that. And the big challenge, of course, is how do you actually fund that? I think a public state broadcaster, that's been a model that's worked for a long time, not saying give up on that model, but there's also other things we can talk about. And one thing I know was touted by the National Union of Journalists for a few years now was an idea that came from the States, which was, you know, what if there was a mechanism where, you know, we gave, like, the government, the state, were to give every citizen a news voucher, which they could spend with a news organization of their choice. And they've proposed, for example, there should be some limits there. They should be purely non-commercial outlets. They should have no advertising. They should hopefully explore models of community and social ownership. I think if people who are listening are not a member, The Ferret is a really good investigative platform that you can join, and you can actually, as a member of it, have an input in what they cover. And I think that's really good. But yeah, the news voucher, this idea of, can we democratize, you know, state-subsidized independent journalism? And that's kind of ideas that I think we should be talking about and we should be exploring, because clearly what's happened now with the BBC is just, you know, sad.
Yeah, and we've seen what's happened, really. You know, the model of billionaires buying up newspapers is obviously not something we support. So we do need to look at alternative organisations, because if that doesn't work in a public sector broadcaster, with the history of the BBC, can be sort of ground down by the right wing, you know, we need to look at other ways to do it, because, you know, you need a media, and people are getting used to no paying for news because they don't need to buy a newspaper anymore. And that's difficult to roll back, because I think news organisations too late try to bring in price walls. But people, when people are used to getting something, nothing, it feels like I want to ask them to start paying again once they get used to that.
I think what was interesting, what Emily Maitlis said, which was great, by the way, I really enjoyed watching the wee video. It was at the Fringe Festival, wasn't it? And it was sponsored by Screen Alapa, Screen Scotland. But I liked it was Gaelic at the bottom. She said that this isn't unusual for governments to meddle in the news. Like she said, it's happened every administration. She named, like, the Blair administration, May. She said this is not an unusual thing. The unusual thing was the speed of the response. Is that right? And what I didn't fully understand was it because the government realised how much they'd fucked up, and they were sort of trying to set a precedent of, you're not going to report on this, you're not going to report on all the consequent stuff that's going to come out? Like, what was their intentions? That's what I want to know about it. And you're right about getting a Scottish state broadcaster, or at least some sort of fundamental body that is independent. And I really like the idea of a news coupons. My brother was moaning. He went and bought a Daily Record for £1.70, and I went, well, that's your own fault buying a Daily Record.
I don't know how much I thought a Daily Record was, but I would never have guessed it was as much as £1.70.
I was shocked. I was like, £1.70?
Cost of living increases.
If I buy a newspaper, it's normally a Sunday paper for the crossword. I actually really like the giant general knowledge crossword that you get in both the Sunday National and the Herald on Sunday. And I buy it for that. And I'm pretty sure that is like £2.40 or something. I don't do it every Sunday.
Just, I mean, it's expensive. And do people have that expendable income for newspapers?
Unless you're burning them to like heat your home, I think probably not.
Yeah, read them and then burn them. So you get a double use out of them.
That's the only entertainment. You can't turn on the TV, so you've got the crossword in the paper, and then you can burn it for heat. There you go.
See, and like, look at this. We're finding multiple layers. You can read the news, do the crossword, then set it in fire.
Probably insulate your windows with them.
This is the future of news media. I kept, look, when I was thinking of Emily Maitland's and the stuff she was saying, I just kept thinking Question Time. You know, and to me, Question Time is like the, you know, the canary for what's going on behind the scenes. The way, like, they've just ruined it because they just stack the audience with Conservative councillors and these far-right lunatics. And then that's trying to convince the public that this is representative of them. And that if you think different, then you're the extremist. You know, like, there was a producer joking on Twitter after, remember during the, I think it was during the NDRF with the Highlander, who was, who was clearly mentally unwell, I would say, you know.
Yeah.
But some producer had obviously got a hold of him and put on, This will go viral. This will get retweets when they put it out on Twitter. This like crazy looking old man ranting about Jesus and the British Army, you know. But I just thought better of Question Time. I thought it was like expected better rather than something as cheap and tawdry as that is just to try to exploit somebody for clicks. Even if he'd been ranting in favour of Scottish independence, he just didn't seem like a well man, and they were taking advantage of that.
When I was in the audience at the BBC leaders debate. Back in, I think it was 2015, and I really enjoyed it. I thought everybody was dead nice, all the runners and everything. Do you need anything? And asking, can I speak back when if he comes back to me, I'm all right responding and all that. They were just, everybody there was dead nice and dead professional. But some of the other questions, it was like, I think this was before they tried to have a balance. Like, you know how now they try to have a balance that's representative of, they have 25% Tories, 25% Labour. You know, they try and balance out the audience a bit more. When I was there, it felt very heavy unionist, to be honest. There was only a couple of questions that were in favour of Scottish independence. And I think all those, you know, BBC bias protests back during NDRF, I was interested in them because I knew people who worked in the Pacific Quay, and they were sending pictures saying they were out, saying, yeah, come on, shouting out the window. So I don't understand fully this. Everybody in the BBC is completely and utterly biased. I don't buy it. I really do think that it's very much an upper echelon thing. And as you say, it's influenced by these, infiltrated by these Tories.
Yeah. I think you touched on it, Connor. Like, there will be people in there that are maybe left wing or pro independence, but they probably know if they speak up too much, they'll know we'll get that promotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the people that even might have their sympathies that want a promotion know the people that they know whether that they need self centre if they want to get ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I know people who work for BBC who I like, and obviously I don't want them to be out of a job, but I think there's an institutional problem at the BBC that I just can't see getting fixed. You know, even if, imagine there's a Starmer government, I'm not imagining that he's going to go in and root out all the problems in the BBC, you know. So I think, you know, I think it's a totally inadequate thing. And all this, like, stuff about balance, like you're saying, Deborah, you get a spell with the people they invite on. It has an impact on political discourse here if you feel pressed that, or if you have, you know, with a transgender rights stuff, for example, they have like, oh, if someone's on here talking about LGBT issues here, we better bring someone else on who would talk against it, which has just become somehow embedded as the thing that responsible journalists have to do. It's never always that case, but it's hard to imagine it being anything different. Or you get the same with now with climate change, the assumption that we might need to bring on a climate skeptic for balance. It's just, what is actually the role of journalism? If it's to try and find out the truth, then that's very different from we're here to put up opinions and pin them against each other and see, you know, people can just make their judgment as to which is right. I think it's a completely wrong model. And I think it actually draws on a little bit of, you know, the US model of broadcasting, which, you know, GB News obviously is the worst example of it in Britain. But I think the BBC actually has taken cues from that. And just because they do it in a nicer, politer accent and without so much shouting doesn't mean that it's not the same thing. Yeah, I don't watch Question Time. I can't bring myself to do
it. No, I've not watched it in years.
I think it's been a decade.
Torturous.
Yeah.
That thing about balance, I find that it always seems to favour the right. If we have an issue where 95% of the opinion is progressive, suddenly they need balance and suddenly it's the representation's 50-50.
Yeah.
But, you know, but suddenly balance goes out the window. If it doesn't favour the right, like you say, if it's I don't know what's doing.
I know what you're getting at.
When it's the right, they don't need balance in the left, basically. Mm-hmm. But see, as a broader service, the BBC service, I can't help but feel it's invaluable. Like right across the radio, you've got all the regional channels. I think it's great. No, it's not wonderful in any way, but I still think it's so vital to so many people. Like every morning in this house, BBC Radio Scotland is on. For our sins. I don't know what, it's just one of the things we do now, wear coffee, listen to Colkey, and Jeannie likes to shout at the radio, keeps her busy.
Yeah, I mean, and I think the BBC as well, you know, a lot of the BBC kind of is infrastructure that the rest of the commercial media rely on. Like, you know, a lot of even quite big media companies, they don't really have like anybody based in Africa. Their Africa correspondent will be based in London and then they'll just piggyback on the news that comes in for the likes of the BBC. So it's, you know, it's not that easy to just say abolish it. I think it's more complicated than that.
I don't want to abolish it, to be clear. I cannot bring myself to lift a finger to defend it when I think it's totally not fit for purpose. And it's got to be replaced by something that can meet that public service remit and be accountable to the people who listen to it and it's meant to serve, rather than accountable to Tory MPs and whoever they put on the board.
I also think a lot of the reaction, positive reaction to Emily Maitlis's comment is interesting because what we mentioned, she's not really saying anything new. You know, but when Corbyn supporters were saying that are pro-independent supporters, they were just sort of dismissed as, you know, borderline conspiracy theorists. Whereas Emily Maitlis is sort of in that nice, sensible, posh club. So now that she's saying it, it's suddenly carrying all this weight.
Yeah, you're right. She did sort of deliver it with a gravitas. And I think that is from an experienced journalist, to be honest. I think she was very personable with it. And like you said, Connor, it's really, she's just decided to share her opinion.
But I think it is also the fact that she's talking about bias in a specific, narrow and limited way. She's saying there's this one person and they intervened over this one story about Dominic Cummings and this is an issue. And of course, there's the allusion to it being a wider issue, but that's also so unthreatening to the fact that there's probably a lot of people who would happily say, okay, well, maybe that goes too far, but overall, it's not so bad. You know, if we consider the bias against the independence movement or the bias against Jeremy Corbyn, there is a lot of people in the UK and within the kind of middle class of journalists and politicians and kind of all these people who have a legitimate right to public expression in Tory Britain, who don't like Boris Johnson, don't like Dominic Cummings, who don't like, you know, this particular wing of the Tory party that's in the ascendancy, and can tolerate that criticism, but would never budge on the things that we would criticise BBC over. So I think that's another thing. Like Emily Maitlis, she's got the gravitas of a journalist. She's allowed to say these things and be taken seriously, but it's also because she's saying it in such a limited way that, you know, people who'd want the BBC to be, you know, 1 degree to the left of where it is, but still right of centre, wouldn't feel threatened by it.
Yeah, why was this the incident that she felt she needed to speak out about? Yeah, that's a fair point.
And we've forgotten, like, even the Tory party has got rid of Boris Johnson. You know, it is, to be a supporter of Boris Johnson is to be right of the Conservative Party, and to be saying it's time for him to go is to be in the Tory party mainstream. So it's not exactly like a radical left-wing thing to criticise. And also, like, it's, how long has it been since Dominic Cummings was a thing? It's been years. It's hardly, you know, going out of your way to, you know, shine light on something pressing to have a go at Dominic Cummings. And, you know, we're most of the way through 2022.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was a while ago and it was she was very sort of limited in the scope of her criticism. But at least it has opened up the channel to talk about this and it be taken more seriously than a fringe issue, because it was somebody in the club that was raising it. Well, I think that's us for this week. Thanks very much for joining us, Connor. Deborah, always a pleasure. This is our final episode of the season. We'll be back probably around the start of October, where I'm sure we'll have a lot of things to discuss about our new Prime Minister, probably Liz Truss.
And we've been promised a revolution by then, so...
Yeah.
I never promise, but I'm just saying, if you see a lot of people in the streets, join them. It'll happen fast, and it will not be televised.
Can I just say, Mona the strikers?
Absolutely.
Solidarity.
Up the workers.
Up the workers.
You can find all our podcasts at leftungagged.org. You can also follow our North American-based monthly podcast, World Beat with George Gollan. You can catch the Talking Sense podcast with Kat and Erin. And if there's anything you'd like us to talk about at Hollywood Ungagged, you can get us on Twitter at _ungagged, # Hollywood Ungagged, or send us an email, ungaggedleft@gmail.com, and put Hollywood Ungagged in the subject line. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us 5 stars in whatever platform you use. Listeners, thanks for listening. Connor, Deborah, thank you for contributing. Always a pleasure. And we'll see you next season. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Good evening. This is the BBC World Service News. I'm Ed Mitchell. The headlines tonight...